Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey guys, just wanted to let you know in this episode, we discuss sexual assault. So just wanted to make sure you listen to this with care.
Hey guys, it's Candace
and Kayla, and we are directionally challenged.
Yep, we thought we would have it all figured out by the time we're in our 30s.
But surprise, we don't.
No, we don't.
And that's okay.
That's okay. That's okay. Today, we're going to talk about sexual assault. We're also going to talk about a term known as stealthing. For those who don't know what it is, we did not know until shortly before recording this podcast. There are a few statistics that that we want to read out just to kind of explain why we wanted to have this conversation with our guest today. So 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men are sexually assaulted while in college. 90% of campus sexual assaults are committed by perpetrators that the survivor knows. 84% of female survivors report being sexually assaulted during their first 4 semesters on campus. This has been called the red zone on college campuses. The majority of undetected college rapists are likely serial perpetrators, committing an average of 6 rapes each. Only 12% of college student survivors report the assault to police. Notably, only 7% of survivors of incapacitated sexual assault report to the police. 63.3% of men at one university who self-reported acts qualifying as rape or attempted rape admitted to committing repeat rapes.
That's right. Today, we are going to sit down with Alexandra Brodsky to discuss this and more. Alexandra Brodsky is the staff attorney at Public Justice. She litigates cases concerning civil rights abuses in schools and the criminal rights system with Public Justice's Students Civil Rights Project and Debtors Prison Project. Alexandra Brodsky is a civil rights lawyer with deep ties to the student movement to end campus gender violence. She holds a JD from Yale Law School and clerked for the Honorable Marsha S. Berzon in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Brodsky has written about sexual assault for the New York Times, The Guardian, The Washington Post, and The Atlantic, among many other publications. Not to mention a book titled Sexual Justice, about supporting victims and ensuring due process is available wherever books are sold. So without further ado, here's our conversation with Alexandra Brodsky.
Alexandra Brodsky, thank you so much for joining us today for this very important conversation. And we're so happy. We have so many women that listen to this podcast. And so I think it's, you know, you can never have this conversation enough about what can happen in the world. And so obviously today we're going to talk about your book, Sexual Justice. We're going to talk about sexual assault. This is very heavy subject matter. But I think what gets so frustrating to me in talking about, especially the statistics of sexual assault on college campuses these days and for young women and young men, is just whenever you read a story or hear a story, just how many common factors exist within those stories. And then also still the fear to report any sexual assault or attempted sexual assault or fear of sexual assault to any sort of law enforcement who would be able to do anything about it. How are we still here? How can we still be reading these statistics? And how are we just not believing survivors and victims at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think we always have to remember that whenever we're hearing about a story in the news about someone who has come forward to report a sexual assault, they are already in the tiny, tiny minority of cases where a survivor feels safe telling everyone at all, where a survivor feels safe taking some kind of formal action. And the vast majority of survivors end up telling, maybe a friend or one family member, but never really moving forward with any kind of formal recourse. And I want to say up front that, you know, for some people, that's the right decision. For some people, based on the reality of our world today, they are making a rational decision that going to law enforcement or reporting to their school or their employer isn't going to serve them. And so, you know, I honor that. And also know that there are so many people who do want to see some kind of justice or need really tangible forms of support that, you know, law and schools and workplaces are set up to provide, but don't feel safe coming forward, often because they fear retaliation, often because they fear that if they come forward, they're going to end up being the one being punished. And I think that there are a lot of hard questions about how we should address sexual assault, how we can do better by survivors. But the first step is making sure that people feel like they have the choice to speak out and to do so safely.
And so that leads us obviously into our next question, is how do we do that? I mean, it's such a broad question, but it's a discussion that we need to continue having.
Yeah, you know, I think that it, you know, the answer really depends in some ways on your role. So I think that for most of us, the first way that we're ever going to relate to an allegation of sexual assault is either as a survivor ourselves or as someone who loves a survivor. Someone who, you know, a survivor trusts to come to confide in. And in that case, our role to make sure that people know that they can come forward safely is to do right by survivors in our lives when they come to us. And also, when we're talking about sexual assault more broadly, when we're talking about gender in our day-to-day lives, knowing that there might be a survivor in the room who's trying to decide whether you're a safe person to come forward to. And so what you say about, you know, a celebrity who's been accused, what you say about a politician who has been accused of sexual assault or says that they've been sexually assaulted might inform whether that person thinks that you'll be there for them. You know, if you dismiss AOC out of hand when she says that she's a survivor, you might think that you are going to dismiss them out of hand. I think that there are then sort of harder structural policy questions about how we prevent retaliation. I will say that I see so many cases these days. I work primarily with students in my day job, and I see so many student survivors who report and then are suspended themselves. Often it's because the school says, well, we don't believe you that you were raped, which means that you just admitted to us that you had sex on school grounds. And so now you're the one who has to leave school. And that should just, I think it is illegal, but if courts don't think it's illegal already, we need to fix that. And we need to make clear that it's illegal.
You said earlier that everyone has a different path. I mean, obviously the root of what is experienced during any sort of assault, physical, sexually, is, I mean, trauma, the biggest letter T, trauma. And everyone handles trauma very differently. And so for some, that may be to go to a friend. For others, that may be to report to some sort of law enforcement and take those next steps. This is a two-parter question. But one is, for anyone that may come across a friend or an acquaintance that does admit that they, you know, had been assaulted, you know, is there any advice that you have as the person who is receiving that information, and how they can support a friend or a loved one who has survived a traumatic event? And I also want to, you know, explain just how difficult it is to come forward to any sort of law enforcement, and what that process is like. And so just kind of exploring both of those avenues and what they mean.
Sure. So, you know, I think that the number one thing that, you know, when someone, when your friend or your family member comes to you and discloses that they've been abused, the first thing to say is, you know, I love you, I believe you, I'm here to support you. And, you know, just making sure that they feel held and safe in that moment. And then I think that often just a really practically helpful thing can be to ask, you know, can I do some research to help figure out your options? You know, do you want me to come with you to have a forensic exam done? Or do you want me to come with you to talk to a lawyer, if that's something that's within their means to do, rather than telling a survivor, I know what's right for you. You know, here, I'm going to call up 911 right now, and we're taking this to the police. Because I think for so many people, they experience sexual violence as a denial of their autonomy. They're a denial of their ability to make choices about their own lives. And so being someone who facilitates a survivor getting to make choices, you know, if you go out and do research and say, if you want to report to the police, here's how we would do it. If you want to, you know, make a report to your school, here's how you would do it. That can be really helpful and can affirm that they're a person who gets to make decisions about how they live their lives and what happens to their body, rather than, you know, imposing our own beliefs about how a survivor should act onto someone we love. In terms of going forward to the police, so I will be honest that in some ways, you know, this is outside of my day-to-day work. I represent primarily students who have experienced sexual violence in civil rights lawsuits. And the civil system is where one person themselves sues a person or an institution, usually for some kind of money damages. And that's in contrast to the criminal system, where someone reports to the police, and then police and prosecutors decide whether to bring a case against, you know, against the defendant on the state's behalf. So in that case, the victim isn't even part of the lawsuit. The victim is at best a witness. And one of the reasons that I decided that I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer rather than help, rather than work within the criminal legal system, is that I have never, I'm just going to be blunt with you, I have never seen the criminal legal system work for a survivor in my life. I know it does for some people out there, but I have over the years worked with so many survivors who were my clients or my friends or my co-organizers, and I don't know a single person who ever saw their case brought to a conviction. And, you know, I should say a lot of people don't want to see the person who hurt them in prison. Another reason I don't want to be a prosecutor is just because of the harm that, you know, can come from incarceration. But to me, it feels like almost the criminal law is almost irrelevant to most survivors' lives. And I don't want to discourage people who might want to see their case prosecuted and might want to explore those options. But I think it's important for everyone to know that the system wasn't designed for survivors. And so if it doesn't work out for them, it's not because what happened to them is okay. It's not because they aren't, you know, they don't deserve to be believed and don't deserve to be supported. It's because it really isn't, as, you know, centered around survivors. But there, for many people, there are other options out there, legal and otherwise, that can give them some sense of closure and support.
What are those options?
I think that this is easiest when we're talking about people who experience sexual harms in the workplace or in schools or in medical care, or in sort of within institutions where, you know, there's an office somewhere whose job it is to handle complaints like these. So, and, you know, most people who have worked an office job have seen an HR department, right? And HR is never your friend. I want to be clear. This is not me saying that the compliance officer is a justice warrior, but those people's jobs is to hear, is to receive complaints of sexual harms and then figure out what the survivor needs for them to stay in school, stay in the workplace, continue to receive the kind of medical care that they need. And so that's one option. And that's something that I talk about a lot in my book, the importance of those options that aren't even, you know, are outside the legal system. They're not even, you know, it's not happening in court. It's happening privately. People can also often bring the civil lawsuits that I was mentioning earlier, which is when rather than a victim going to the police and hoping the state will go after the person who hurt them, the survivor, him or herself, brings a lawsuit directly against the person who hurt them or the institution that allowed it to happen. And at the end of that, incarceration isn't on the line, but often survivors can receive some kind of monetary support. And I know that for a lot of people, that feels trivializing. It seems like we're putting a price on sexual violence. But you know, if you talk to survivors, what so many people will say is, I just needed help getting back on my feet. I needed to go to therapy. I needed to pay off medical debt. I needed to take some time off from work. I needed to move so I didn't see the person who raped me down the hall every day. And my money judgment allowed me to do that. And, you know, that practical solution is helpful. Now, the problem with this is you usually have to get a lawyer, and not everyone can find a lawyer who can will work with them for free. There are, you know, I sort of just want to emphasize that there are options out there for survivors when the criminal law doesn't help them.
You have such a vast experience representing young victims of sexual assault. We have a lot of young listeners on this podcast. So whether it's something that they have experienced or know someone who's experienced, I think it's just really key and important that we let them know what they can do to try to help others in that situation, what they can do themselves to help themselves in that situation, and what the first step is. Because I think a lot of people don't realize that when you share your experience, you're almost reliving the experience. And so people don't want to share it. Mm. So what are just some advice for them? Because, you know, the reality is these statistics are high. And I want to make sure that our listeners are aware and ready if and when they ever find themselves in a situation like this.
Yeah, that's a great question, because you're right that young people, particularly young women, are at increased risk for sexual violence, but are often at a stage in their lives when they don't have feel every day like they have a lot of choices available to them. You know, especially if you're a kid and you're going to school every day and adults are constantly watching you and there are so many rules about how you can behave and not, it can sometimes be hard to feel like you have a lot of choices. You know, I think I would say that if a survivor has a trusted adult in their life that they feel like they can talk to, I would really encourage them to do so. A thing that I will flag, and this will sound, this is not meant to discourage anyone, but just sort of as a thing that they might want to research, is that particularly in for high school students, if they're under 18, there are sometimes state laws that require that, let's say, a teacher, if they hear that a minor is being sexually abused, that they have to inform the police. And not all survivors want that. And so a survivor might want to ask first, are you a mandatory reporter? You know, can I disclose this to you in private? And sometimes a therapist or someone like that will have a little more options for confidentiality. I would encourage people, even if they're not comfortable to telling anyone yet, even just writing down in a diary what happened can be helpful later if they want to pursue some kind of investigation, or honestly, just to know for yourself that you didn't make it up. It happened and mm-hmm. you knew it at the time. And these are the mm-hmm. details. Sometimes people's memories can degrade in ways that they forget little details that might be helpful later. I will say, though, you know, speaking of young people, that I actually find the anti-violence work that Gen Z is doing incredibly inspiring. I feel like I'm worried that this will sound trite, but I know that when I came into college, I had such a really basic understanding of consent. I don't even know if anyone had ever used that word for me. I thought that it was like, I guess no means no. That was kind of it. And I remember once in college, we wrote an op-ed, some activists and I, that used the term rape culture. And that people lost their minds. They're like, what is this word, this term that you made up? Do you think everyone's just talking about their favorite kind of rape over breakfast now? Like every 14-year-old knows about rape culture from TikTok. And that does a lot of work, you know, talking with each other about what sexual respect looks like, does so much work to prevent violence before we even need to start talking about what to do in its aftermath.
God, what I wouldn't give to really understand what, just hear the word consent as a young teenager. It would have reframed my entire view on just my perspective on sex in general, my own sexuality. It was interesting to really have an understanding about what consent means in adulthood for the first time.
Oh,
versus being a young adult or a teenager.
100%. And I mean, I think about how many of the messages that I got as a teenager about sex were contrary to them, not just incomplete, but really contrary to an understanding of sex, where it was really, don't let boys do things to you. You know, you're the gatekeeper. This is never something you could possibly want, but you're the gatekeeper and they're going to try to get over that gate. And it's your job to just keep them out. And that left out the idea that young women might be interested in sex on their terms. And also that right. It's also on boys and men to make sure that they're listening, not just that they're just constantly kind of running into your barriers and you're trying to keep them out. And if they get through, that means you didn't do a good enough job.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a minute.
Dear Ashley Challenge.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
It's time to get more in 2024. I know for me, one of my goals is to feel really strong this year. And honestly, so far, so good. Because that's where 310 Nutrition comes in. It's helping me and our listeners in the new year with protein and super rich food products with so many options and flavors. Right now I have the Chocolate Bliss and Caramel Sundae, and they are both so delicious. I have to hide them from my husband so that he doesn't steal them too. They're a triplex protein blend, plant-based proteins that include pea, brown rice, and pumpkin that leave me feeling full. 310 Nutrition also has a hydrate electrolyte drink mix. My favorite is the peach mango flavor. So not only am I hydrating and drinking water, I have an electrolyte blend, vitamin blend, and it's sugar-free. With one stick of hydrate mix into 16 ounces of water, and it can provide the same amount of hydration equal to drinking 2 to 3 bottles of water. Thank you. This way I can keep my resolution, keep feeling strong, have greater focus, feel refreshed, and maintain my hydration without having to drink as much. One of my favorite refreshing water enhancers they have is the lemonade flavor. It gives me energy. This one's also sugar-free. It's used with real lemons and it's pH balanced. And this also offers the same hydration as 2 to 3 bottles of water. Right now, 3-10 is celebrating a new year of goals with code CHALLENGED and giving our listeners 50% off up to $100 for your first order. With so many sample packs, new products, it's really fun and easy to put together an order or start a subscription on products that you know you'll use and will help you keep your resolution. So go to 310nutrition.com and use the code CHALLENGED right now for 50% up to $100 for your first order. That's 310-nutrition.com and use code CHALLENGED. It's all the good stuff your body needs in flavors you crave. So be healthier effortlessly.
And we're back. It's, you know, you were talking about what survivors and victims can do, and just even just writing down a journal entry or just writing it down if you feel that something traumatic has occurred is like a first step. And there's a few cases that kind of came to mind and that were really publicized in the last couple of years when we were going to sit down together today. One of them was Dr. Christine Blasey Ford. And the fact that what she was trying to do was just, this was meant to be a statement of someone's character. And for anyone that doesn't know or has forgotten who Dr. Ford is, she alleged that Brett Kavanaugh attempted to rape her in the early 80s when they were teenagers at a house party. And so he was facing other allegations of misconduct following Ford's description of the alleged assault. And this all happened when they were in high school. Brett Kavanaugh denied the claims. This was all when he was set to be appointed as Supreme Court, who he is a Supreme Court justice now. But instead of it being just someone coming forward to testify about someone's character, it turned into a Republican Democrat, fighting for a very coveted seat in our judicial system. But it all revolved around, you know, what she couldn't remember, or trying to every single little detail. And I think that that is what is so traumatizing for maybe anyone who's been, you know, the victim of a sexual assault before, to try to say, well, what if I don't remember every single detail? What if my mind has blocked out certain things? What if I just remembered something because a sense memory triggered, what had happened? And I think that that's so hard. That's the most difficult thing, is for anyone watching that case play out, you know, to maybe consider, well, what if I'm not believed because I don't know every single detail of what happened? And she's being questioned over things that happened, you know, decades before she was, you know, sharing very clear details, as much as she could remember. How are people supposed to see something like that and then feel comfortable coming forward to report a traumatic event if they don't have every single detail, you know, readily available at the top of their memory?
Yeah, I think that, you know, watching that was a really demoralizing experience for so many people. And to me, it really highlights what a catch-22 this all is, because a natural response to trauma is to block out certain details. And so the fact that you were sexually abused might be the reason that you can't remember every single detail about why, you know, everything that happened when you were sexually abused. And I should say, you know, I think that people often discount how much evidence survivors do have. They, you know, discount what the memories that survivors do hold on to. I mean, a huge sort of plot line of that whole hearing was people saying that maybe Dr. Ford had just gotten the wrong guy, that she was telling the truth, but she was misremembering who it was. So even when she did have a clear memory, they discounted it. But it's certainly true that not remembering every single detail is a common experience. And people are really always on the lookout for ways to discredit someone who comes forward. And for me, that's actually one of the reasons why I'm really invested in thinking about ways to support survivors that don't turn on them proving their case. And I know that might sound sort of tricky, like, well, doesn't someone have to prove their case? And sure, they might, for someone to be fired or for someone to go to prison. Of course, you're going to have to be able to demonstrate what happened to you. But there are so many other things that survivors need in the wake of violence, like counseling, not having to share a shift anymore at their job with the person who hurt them. And none of that should need to turn on someone having enough evidence, because it doesn't really come at any cost to the other person. And so I think sometimes I think about sort of turning away from a focus on believing survivors to a focus on supporting survivors, that is ultimately what this all comes down to.
Yeah, the Brock Turner case was also something that was at the forefront of my mind. And I read the entirety of the victim's impact statement and just how, gut-wrenching and also powerful and really important what she needed to say. In the Brock Turner case is another example of where this actually all just, it all happened really pretty much in order, in like a timely fashion. You know, this was a tragic circumstance of a young girl who was at a college party on Stanford campus, who was found by two bicycle riders unconscious, being assaulted by a young boy who would be Brock Turner. We know this was Brock Turner because he was caught by the two boys on the bicycle as he fled the scene. The young girl who was known in the press and the news was known as unconscious woman or unconscious girl. That's how she was listed. Brock Turner was always listed as a champion swimmer, caught assaulting unconscious girl. But she woke up in the hospital. She was immediately, went through all the forensics in order to be tested. She couldn't recollect all of the events, but there were cell phone records that matched her story. And she still had to fight in court for well over a year, saying, "I was not only told I was assaulted, I was told that because I couldn't remember, I technically could not prove it was unwanted." So even though she was assaulted, they had all the evidence, but because she was unconscious when it was happening, they were like, "Well, you can't prove that you didn't want it." And so even when it's right there, this isn't decades before it happened. It happened just, then. And she went through all the steps and she was still told, "You got to prove it, that you didn't want it and that you didn't like it." How are we still here as a society? And this was just one singular case. It was also Stanford. Yeah, it's like...
Yeah, it's really an impossible task. And this goes, again, to just like, this is not a system that is meant for survivors. I mean, I think about how, for many years, for centuries, it was actually seen as a big ding against your credibility if you as a woman came forward and said you were sexually assaulted. You needed your dad or your husband to come to the police and say, "This was a violation against me, this man who owns this woman, this man who is responsible for this woman. And it was a violation when this person sexually assaulted my daughter or sexually assaulted my wife, they were injuring my property, really." And that is luckily not the way that it works today, but it's still true that the injury in a criminal case is against the state. It's not, the victim, again, isn't even a party to that lawsuit. And so often is treated as really disposable, is treated as someone almost who's getting in the way rather than the person who this process is supposed to serve. One of the things that has always really stuck with me from the Brock Turner case, which I talk about a little bit in my book, and the philosopher Kate Mann has a great discussion of in her book, Down Girl, is the ways in which, even though at the end of the day, Turner was convicted, a jury said he did this, that everyone knew that he wasn't really a rapist. He was this nice white boy who went to Stanford with a promising future. And so the judge said, I know he did this, but he's not like a rapist. He's not the real kind. And, which means that, even when people are believed, they aren't believed. Even when they're believed, it's assumed to be some kind of accident or fluke rather than, part of a, terrible pattern of violence, particularly against women, that is facilitated by the kind of entitlement actually that people like Turner, people who go to Stanford, people who have bright futures, people who are white, are uniquely positioned to feel. He felt entitled to the world, and as part of that, he felt entitled to his victim's body.
It's forgive us. It's a hard conversation to have sometimes. And sometimes I lack the words to express it. What I really want to shed light on is stealthing. You know, California lawmakers approved a bill that would outlaw stealthing and allow victims to sue sexual partners who remove condoms without consent. I'm going to be really honest with you. Stealthing was not a term that I was familiar with until we decided to have this discussion with you on the podcast. But before we get into how a single paper from a Yale law student changed legislation, can we start with the basics so that our listeners can catch up to me and us? What is stealthing?
Stealthing or non-consensual condom removal is when two people agree to have sex. I guess it could be more than two, but usually fact pattern, two people agree to have sex with a condom. And then in the course of that sex, one of the people removes the condom without the other person's consent. And so in that moment, the sex transitions from being something that's wanted and consensual to being something that's non-consensual.
When was the first time you had heard about stealthing? The first time I'd actually heard about it was Lena Dunham did a piece in her book about condom removal. She wrote a vulnerable piece about someone that she was sleeping with who removed the condom, I think, multiple times. And it was the first time that I'd ever heard anyone talk about something that, you know, I just had never heard about this actually talked about publicly. And also saying, hey, guys, that's not cool. Guys can't just remove condoms in the middle of sex. That changes the game. And that's a big no-no. You know, going back to having conversations about consent, this was another big one that I wish was explained to me as a young adult. So when was the first time you heard about stealthing and was like, hey, guys, we got to change this and make this illegal?
Yeah, you know, I think I probably learned about it shortly after graduating from college. I had gotten involved as a student with anti-rape organizing at my school and then connected with students at other schools who were doing similar work. And, you know, through that, I connected to so many survivors who had experienced all kinds of sexual violence. And one thing that I saw all the time, which really runs against a lot of the myths that we have against about sexual violence, is that a lot of this violence was happening in the context of otherwise consensual sexual and romantic relationships. It was, you know, boyfriends doing this, girlfriends doing this. It was one night stands doing this. And I should say this sort of, you know, sexual violence more broadly. But for me, non-consensual condom removal was such a terrible and also perfect example of this kind of violence that goes overlooked precisely because it's happening within otherwise consensual sex. And it's happening to someone who's sexually active. You know, it's not happening to our myth of the perfect rape victim who is this like virginal goddess who's, you know, a white woman who's never spoken to a man before and is sexually assaulted walking down the street. This is happening to someone who wants sex, who likes sex, but just doesn't want the sex to be like that and has their consent violated when their partner changes the conditions of sex. It had sort of stuck with me as a troubling example that sort of the site of so many different myths and biases about sexual violence coming to bear in, you know, one particular form of abuse. And so I wrote a paper about it in law school. I took a class on sexuality in the law and I needed to write a term paper. And I wrote that. I will be honest with you that I thought that, you know, maybe my mom would read it. My professor would read it. And that was about it. And then on a whim, I submitted it to publication at an academic journal. Again, thinking that meant that, you know, there would be a tiny academic audience, but it ended up making its rounds online and eventually got the attention of a assemblywoman in California.
You know, there's this interesting dynamic here that it's such a common thing, but a lot of people feel like it doesn't happen to other people. And so when you were writing this term paper and you thought that of course your mom would read it and there would be a smaller audience here, were you able to interview people in person about their experiences and what was that like? Did you know someone who had been through this? Why did you choose this specific topic?
Yeah, I interviewed a couple of people, including, you know, some who I, you know, knew already, some who I didn't. And yeah, it was really interesting how many people thought that they were the only one who had experienced this. I think because there's already, in any case, so many people experience a lot of shame disclosing that they've been sexually assaulted. And I think, again, in this context where someone has agreed to have sex with this person, I think that there are often additional feelings of shame, like it's their fault, that they should have known better, that it's embarrassing to admit to having sex at all, you know, when you're, especially when you're a young person. And so many people hadn't heard stories, hadn't told anyone else that it had happened to them. One thing that was interesting in talking to people for the paper is that some of them had experienced other forms of sexual violence as well. And some felt very strongly that there was a connection, that stealthing was another kind of rape. And some felt strongly that it was bad, but that it was different than their other experiences, that it, you know, the term that I ended up using was, you know, rape adjacent. And I didn't, it felt really, I didn't want to be in that situation, the person saying, you don't think you've been raped, but you have been raped. You know, I didn't want to, again, be taking away autonomy from someone to label their own experiences. So I ultimately in that paper didn't decide one way or another, you know, whether it is rape or it's like rape or it's not rape, but just explore the different ways that the law might be able to help survivors who had experienced this particular kind of harm.
Shame is the root of so much of why sexual assault cases go unreported, and you know, even acknowledging, you know, an act like stealthing and condom removal during consensual sex, making it non-consensual. You know, this idea of, I would assume, like, I should have known better, you know, like I should have known better, you know, even discussing some of the other cases that we were talking about. I should have known better not to drink so much. I should have known better. You know, I should have been so aware of us having sex that I could tell the difference when they were wearing a condom and when they weren't wearing a condom. How do we, as a society of women and men who have experienced this, just of humans, how do we as a society of humans begin to unpack some of that shame and let go of the should haves and would haves and just give ourselves some grace and acknowledging, you know, the wrongdoing?
Yeah,
by someone else.
I think it's so hard. I mean, I think you're right that this is the root of so much of it in stealthing and in other cases, and particularly in cases that are the ones where we don't hear a lot of stories about, but which we know are the vast majority of cases, which is people who are assaulted by people that they know, who were assaulted while drinking or using drugs or, you know, doing something that they should or, you know, quote unquote, shouldn't have done. And I think that for a lot of people, blame is a way of asserting control or pretending to have control. So I hear this, you know, particularly when women will say, oh, you know, she was asking for it because she dressed that way, or she was asking for it because she drank too much. And what women are saying in that situation is, I want to believe that this won't happen to me. I want to believe that it couldn't happen to me because I'm the responsible one. I would never put myself in that situation. And the truth is that not drinking is not going to protect you. And not going out isn't going to protect you, especially in a world in which, again, most people are sexually assaulted by someone they know, someone that they could invite into their home, by a partner, by a spouse, by a friend. But it's a way of blame. So for them, blame is a way of feeling safe. And then I think that gets internalized by a lot of survivors. And, you know, again, this is where I think for the vast majority of us, the way that we're going to make change around sexual violence is what we say to the people around us, what we say to survivors that confide in us, and just the way that we talk about these issues with our friends and our family, and being just, you know, even just a small change maker and making sure to, you know, not promote that kind of shame ourselves and to call it out when we hear it around us, that can have a real ripple effect into, you know, people's real lives.
I think the hardest thing, so I'm a stepmom of teenage girls. And of course, like, I always want to just, you want to protect them from the world. You want to protect them from everything. You don't want them to slip on a banana peel. You don't want them to, you know, back their car and at a parking lot into another car. And you want to tell them, you know, you want them to be safe at all times, and you can't protect them from the world. The world is a freaking scary place, and it's a big place. And I've always had a hard time trying to walk the line of how do you, you know, share with a young woman, like, you know, protect yourself with also not then putting this, like, the weight of that scary world on their shoulders. And, you know, and also in a world where I don't always feel safe, where I'm, you know, still walking to the car with the key in between my fingers as if I'm going to be able to stab an assailant, you know, when in reality, I might just, like, cower into the fetal position and scream and cry. And so how do we talk to young women about the realities of protecting themselves in this big, scary world and the realities of sexual assault?
Yeah, I think that that is such a tough question. And I think it's a really fine line to give people information that they can use without suggesting that it is their responsibility to stop themselves from being sexually assaulted. And I think that it is really hard to communicate that. I think it requires being a little bit blunt. Like, I think it maybe requires saying at the start, the middle, and the end, I want to be clear that I am saying that if anything ever happens to you, it is not your fault. It is not your responsibility. But I want you to know that this is a thing that happens in the world, and for you to be able to do what the little bit that is within your control to decrease the chances. And so, you know, maybe one concrete example is, we know that alcohol doesn't cause rape in the sense that it's not, you know, young women drinking that causes rape to appear out of nowhere. But we also know that perpetrators use alcohol as a weapon. And they use alcohol to target people and to incapacitate them. And so informing a young person about that isn't saying it's your fault if you drink, but it's saying, hey, this is a tactic that abusers use that you might want to keep an eye out for. And so that's still keeping responsibility ultimately with the person who causes the harm while providing some information. I also think that honestly that positive sex education for young people does so much work to reduce violence that doesn't have to come along with blame and shame, and can actually do a lot to reduce blame and shame. But I think we were talking earlier about how little consent ed we had. I think that I didn't have a really good vision for what, a healthy relationship looked like, what good sex looked like. And you can communicate so much by holding that up as a model so that people can tell, I deserve, you know, when there are warning signs, I deserve to be treated better than this. If someone is every single time we fool around is pushing my boundaries in ways that make me uncomfortable, I deserve to walk out that door. It's not my responsibility, but I deserve to walk out that door.
And I just want to specify, because this is so key, and I want our listeners to really be well-equipped when in those situations. Walking out that door means calling it out right away, correct? And then ending the relationship and not going back to it in a time of weakness, and really knowing their self-worth and their value, and knowing that that relationship isn't everything. Because I think the hard part is, we're talking about mainly high school and college and these really highly emotional times in life that understandably the pressure's high. And so to have fun and escape and be with others and feel loved is all part of the experience. But to know the difference and know the line of what makes them comfortable and what is uncomfortable, and feeling the confidence and the self-worth to call it out and stopping it right then, and knowing that there are other relationships in life and there are more valuable things in life, and that this isn't everything.
Yeah. And again, you know, I always have this moment. I think, Candace, this goes to your initial question about, you know, I don't want to suggest that it's someone's fault if they don't feel safe leaving. And I know, you know, most people who leave abusive relationships leave multiple times. And, it, you know, it takes a couple times.
I think they say seven on average. It takes like seven times. It's very hard to leave an abusive relationship.
Yeah. So I know it's not as easy as like some random lady on a podcast saying that you should leave and then being like, okay, now I'm going to leave.
Right.
But I also know, I mean, again, you know, this is maybe a little clearer in sort of sexual assault cases, but, you know, I think that I really grew up on this idea that there's this script where, you know, sex happens between a man and a woman, and the man just asks and asks and asks and pushes and pushes and pushes. And eventually the woman, you know, she tries to fight him off as long as possible, and then maybe eventually relents. And so when people followed that sexual script, it just felt normal to me, rather than something, rather than a red flag, rather than a flag that this person isn't concerned about what you want, you know, isn't concerned about keeping you safe and you feeling comfortable and enjoying it. And so having, knowing how good sex can be, I think is often a great way to help people know that they can demand more and get out when they're not getting it.
Mm-hmm. And I know we've kept you, but I really want to ask and make sure we talk about, what does it feel like to be the driving force behind such a powerful piece of legislation? I know earlier you had brought up Christina Garcia, who is the assembly member who co-sponsored the bill, and she herself has been a victim of stealthing. And this bill was signed October 7th, 2021. This is brand new, and this will likely pave the way for others in the future. So what does that feel like to be the driving force behind such a powerful piece of legislation?
It's really wild. I have to be honest with you. I mean, I feel like I yes. have to say that obviously, you know, like no one person gets a bill over the line. So, you know, this wouldn't have happened without Assemblymember Garcia, who has been working for years to get a bill passed. And I know that it really does take a village. Like, man, I did not see that coming. you know, I think that mostly the lesson I've gotten from it is that, you know, like, I'm a lawyer. I spend a lot of time working very hard on technical arguments in front of a desk all day. And I do think that that stuff is important. But also, like, there are few things as powerful as just naming the problem, especially when it's something like stealthing that is at this weird Venn diagram of really common and no one talks about. And, you know, I don't think that my paper was like the most brilliant paper that a law student has ever written. But, you know, I don't think that that's why it had this impact. I think that it had an impact because it put something on paper that people weren't talking about, and it related to their lives, and that gave other people a vocabulary to make change. And that, I don't know, that's, I think that that's ultimately an optimistic story.
Mm-hmm. I also, I'm really embarrassed to have to ask, know your, how do you address the website? IX or?
Know your nine. Yeah, but it is IX. So that's good for a know website. It's okay. Good to flag that it's IX, not the normal
Perfect.
Nine. Yeah.
So we also want to talk about Know Your Nine. You can go to www.knowyourix.org. Can you tell us a little bit about this organization and what you're doing currently and what your goals are upcoming?
Yeah, absolutely. So Know Your Nine is a youth-led anti-violence group that I co-founded, I guess when I was 23, so almost a decade ago now. That is working to make sure that students know their rights under the federal civil rights law Title IX, which requires schools to provide support so that survivors can continue to learn in the wake of violence. And Know Your Nine also works to bring student voices to policymakers, because there's often like a group of 55-year-olds together, no offense, trying to figure out what students need and not actually listening to student survivors to hear what will make a difference in their lives. And so, you Know Your Nine was another thing that sort of started small and has, to my surprise, gotten big. My friend and I thought that it was going to be basically a social media campaign over a summer. We were going to like make some graphics and put them on then Facebook and have that circulate. But it's now a organization that has survived my departure. I'm no longer credibly a youth organizer, so I now, you know, advise the organization, but am not staffed there anymore. But they're doing really incredible work, and a lot of that is coming to the fore right now because during the Trump administration, the Department of Education made some new Title IX rules that are really terrible for survivors. And the Biden administration has promised that they will change those, but it's really dragging its feet. And so Know Your Nine is doing a lot of work to make sure that those rules come out soon and that they are really meaningful protections for survivors.
Alexandra Brodsky, we are so grateful that we sat down with you, and we are so honored that you are doing so much for so many and that you will continue to do so. Where can people follow you and find you if they want to continue to help support or track what's happening?
I am probably most accessible on Twitter. I'm at AZ Brodsky. I'm not talking in my capacity as my day job, but I work for an organization called Public Justice. I litigate cases there, and I have this new book out, Sexual Justice, where I'd be really grateful if people who are interested in this topic would give it a read and let me know what they think.
We'll have the link to purchase the book in our show notes and on our socials. Alexandra, you're a badass. Thank you so much.
You are.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We want to thank Alexandra Brodsky for sitting down with us and having this important discussion. I know Candace and I felt really compelled to sit down with her and discuss this, and we're really grateful that she took the time in her busy schedule to do this.
If you guys want to read up more on this subject matter of sexual assault, sexual justice, you guys can check out Alexandra Brodsky's book, available everywhere, titled Sexual Justice, Supporting Victims, Ensuring Due Process, and Resisting the Conservative Backlash. You can also visit the website we spoke about towards the end for more information, www.knowyour9.org. Nine is IX, so that is www.knowyour9.org.
We hope you found this episode of Directionally Challenged informative. We have another great one coming for you next week. We'll see you then.
Directionally Challenged is a production of Pineapple Productions.
Producer, Melissa DeMonts. Post-production sound by Chris Henry.
Music by Joe King.
And advertising partnership with Acast.